Accession number 28698, Reel 7.
Major Lawton. Major Lawton, Reel 7. Now, you're doing this training, and at what point then were you actually training as attacking someone or defending against someone? When did that come into your training?
Well, we started off doing the platoon exercises first, and then we went off and did the company exercise where we marched from the drop-off point within Ulu Taram, and we had to go up the whole of Mount Panti, which is the highest mountain in that part of Malaya. And we had a company commander, and we went round and round, and we thought we could see Mount Panti, and we're saying, well, where are we going to stop? And he wasn't sure of where he was, or we convinced he wasn't sure where he was. And we ended up having to stop at night, and it was got dark. And like I said before, you're supposed to do everything in the daylight before it gets dark. So we just had to stop where we were and cook where we were. And we couldn't see where we were or what we were doing. So we just ate and drank, and we heard some water running, so we filled our water bottles up. And even in the night, it looked rather milky water. So we cooked, and then as daylight came and we all looked round, we were covered in rats as big as dogs, and the water was white and milky, and it was coming out of a lead mine or something like that. And yet we'd been drinking it through the night because we'd get in there too late to do anything about it, and we were physically in a swamp at the bottom of the bloody mountain. And the company commander at the time wouldn't admit that we're in the wrong place, but hey ho. And there was a few other adventures on that particular exercise, because we had one guy who busted his appendix. And of course, he couldn't get anywhere in unless he came in by helicopter. So what we had to do in the middle of the night was chop a DZ or an LZ for the helicopters to come in. And it was a stormy night. It was silent and down. And the message had gone to Singapore, to their headquarters. And the Air Force pilots, helicopter pilots, said they weren't going to come out. And the Army pilots wouldn't come out. So a Navy pilot came out. And our platoon sergeant at the time, Jock Forsyth, brought him in on a right-angle torch in the pitch black, and the helicopter came down as far as it could, sent the ropes down with a stretcher on, and he was hitting, his rotor blades were hitting the tops of the trees. And we put Vicky King on the stretcher and got him out. He got taken back to Singapore to the BMH, and his appendix did bust, but they saved his life. And they were going to court-martial the helicopter pilot for taking his helicopter out in such foul weather, in the middle of the night, in the middle of a storm. But I think then he got commandeered later for saving the lad's life anyway. And that was our CO, had to stick up for the pilot. And there was the other things we taught in the, or learned in the jungle, was the resupply in the day and night, where helicopters and planes would come across and everything was sent in by parachute. And then, of course, you had to go through the jungle to find the parachutes, to find your food, to find your stores and your ammunition. And they used to come down on bunny coloured parachutes, pinks, and lilacs and yellows and greens and all the lovely colours. And we used to keep that silk, the parachute, was put on it in, and we used to make pyjamas out of it called zoot suits. And if you got the black ones, the ones that came in at night and stuff like that, you had black zoot suits. But we used to keep them, and they were good for sleeping in at night. So instead of getting your dry uniform in the middle of the night wet, you'd put a zoot suit on and sleep in the zoot suit, and that would keep the mozzies and everything off as well. Because if you remember, I was saying you always kept one dry suit. So if you'd been going through swamps and rivers all day, you had to keep this in polythene bags nice and dry. Because at night time, you would put the dry suit on, so at least you get a comfortable night's sleep, if you weren't on guard. And no matter what you got up next morning, or how cold it was, or how wet it was, and the monsoon rains lashing down, you had to take your dry suit off under cover, and put your wet, cold, stinking, slimy, horrible suit back on. Because it was going to get wet and muddy all day anyway. And then roll your dry suit up and put it nice and dry inside your Bergen again and tie it up in polythene. Because if you got both suits wet, you had no way of sleeping on a night time. And then you'd go yellow and you'd get all the diseases and everything else. So if you could get one of these zoot suits made up by the natives and that, they were a godsend.
Communications, what were those?
Oh, we had A-40s and A-41 radios and the old C-36 or something, and in the jungle used to carry a hand generator that used to bore into the side of a tree, and when you're on a night time you take turns winding the handle for half an hour at a time, then the next man would take off, and that would power your batteries up for your radios.
But communications was terrible. but you go to clearance and you put your 20-foot mast up, and then you could talk from base to base to base. But actually in the jungle, you set off and you just had to rely on radio silence. But you did, if you needed to speak from a base, you'd have the wind-up generators, and soldiers would just take turns winding the handle.
Did you come across natives living in the area?
Yes, we did. And same thing, you'd swap bits and pieces, you'd give them food and they'd give you knives and stuff like that. And you weren't supposed to make too much contact with them unless it was part of the exercise you were taking. And they'll have been warned off by people saying you've got troops moving through your place. But yeah, you did. And again, it was fascinating to see how they worked, lived and relied on the rivers for getting through the jungle.
Did any of them act as guides as part of your training?
Not at our level, but I think they did a battalion level. Like Borneo, where they'd have the Dayaks and stuff like that. I don't think we had any official like Dayaks or anybody with us, but I'm sure they were there. And we used to use the Gurkhas as well.
Did you come across, well, obviously, you came across the Gurkhas.
Well, the Gurkhas were in the same camp.
Yeah. What did you find then?
Absolutely brilliant. You could never tell what age group they were, because we'd play volleyball against them. And you would look and you think, Christ, they all look in their 30s or the 40s. But they'll be jumping about 7 feet high and they'll be hammering us. No, I always got on well with Gurkhas. And when you weren't, like, in the jungle, but you were doing duties within your barracks or in the jungle warfare school, of course, you wore pressed and starched OG shorts and horse tops and putties and your boots and that. And you had a cinema in the jungle warfare school, so you'd go to the pictures. And it was still the days where the Queen used to come on the end, sitting side saddle on a horse. And if the British soldiers didn't stand up, the Gurkhas used to go absolutely berserk. They used to go absolutely berserk. And, no, we got on well with the Gurkhas.
I presume they stood up. They
absolutely. Yeah. Ramrod stiff. Yeah. Well, so did most of the soldiers, but you'd always get some, especially if they'd been drinking. And the Gurkhas, no, you stand up, it's your queen. And it used to really go their ends. Yeah.
The type of food you're carrying with you, I know you did your own cooking, but certainly from the bulk side, you couldn't carry up that much.
No, we used to try and carry 2 or 3 days, but it was all tins in them days. And your biggest part of your meal was like an Irish stew. And I just can't think of the name of it now.
McConaghy's, that kind of thing.
Anyway, it was a big time mutton stew with a fattener in it. And your bacon was really salty, strippy bacon, really, really salty. And your milk was the Condell's milk, like in a tube of toothpaste. And your hardtack biscuits. But you carried a lot of noodles as well. So they would be quite packed. And water was always on a ration. I mean, you always use your last mouthful of tea, if you want, for your actually shaving, because you had to shave in the jungle. Or our battalion did anyway. And so you'd use the last dregs of your tea as your shaving water. So you would use your water for your cup of tea, and you take that first clean out, and then you put your other half a cup of water in, and that would heat your noodles up. And then you eat your noodles, and you drink your tea, and you drink your noodles, and then your last bit of tea, you kept that water, and you shave and stuff like that. And that. Unless you could find a stream or find water somewhere, and then you put it in your burlap bag, strain that, put your, tablets in it, your purifying tablets in it, purify your water, let it drip all night, and at least you always try and keep 2 water bottles full of water. But sometimes you would end up with no water, and the helicopters would have to come in again with underslung nets and drop the water through the jungle for you, through the jungle canopy for you.
Did you have any of those self-heating tins?
No, I've never used them in my life, actually. I've never physically used them in our life. No, it was all like tins and packets of food, and that's why this day and age now we have flexi packets and no tins. Because they say what you take in the jungle, you've got to fetch out. So even when you've eaten the food, you've got to keep carrying your tins around all the time with you. I mean, you used to flatten them and everything else, but you were still carrying more weight than you wanted to carry. Because you were carrying radio batteries, you'd be carrying mortar bombs, you'd be carrying all your ammunition, you'd be carrying as much water as you could. Which goes back to the old condoms as well.
So how much weight then would be on your back?
Well, you'd be carrying 40 pounds if you were going out, or because really you were out all week and you wouldn't come back till Friday night.
It's quite a spell, isn't it?
It is. It used to wear you down as well, because really, even in the good part of the jungle, you could only go a mile an hour. So, in an 8-hour day, you hadn't travelled that many miles, but you were chopping all the time, intercontinental of chopping. Unless you were going into a defensive area, you'd put an ambush up, then you'd chop, get in the area, and then you would sleep on the area. But if there was 10 of you lined up, all the odd numbers would sleep and the even numbers would keep guard, and then an hour later you wake him up, and so you never moved, and you'd actually wee in the spot. You'd just like turn sideways and wee, and hopefully you wouldn't have to go for anything else. But and that's what I did. So half would sleep, half would wake, and that way you would never have to move out the ambush area. So
what was the principles of ambush layout? How would you lay out?
Most of the jungle would be linear, but you'd obviously put a triangle to the back. So if the main track, and there's not many tracks in the jungle, but if you knew the enemy or anybody was using that particular track because it was parallel with a river, or they were coming down the river because it's the only way you get through the jungle, you would do a linear in line. But you would also have stops going that way and stops going backwards. So if they got behind you, you would also have another line of defence, like an open block if you want, so the enemy couldn't come behind you. And you would always have Ayas and Tobias, which was a listening device, which would one would work off the other. So once you cut the beam, whoever's on stag, and they'll count the bips coming through, and then say, right, the bulk of the enemy inside that and that, and then everybody would open fire and shoot into the enemy, and hopefully you caught them all in the middle and nobody could come around the back of you.
Did you actually fire your weapons as part of your training in the jungle itself?
Blank ammunition, but we would do demonstrations with the claymores. I mean, you see the Americans using claymores on their films. If it was only that easy to go out and put them up and set them off, it is not, and they're bloody dangerous.
What are claymores?
Claymores are the plastic containers about 7 inches by 5 inches, curved in shape like that, full of ball bearings with the explosive behind, and the ball bearings would go out in a fan and it would kill anybody in front. Brilliant weapon, but not made as simple as what you see the Americans on their films do, but very, very effective. The ideal weapon system in the jungle. And we used to do it, but we used to do it for demonstration purposes only. Same with Bangalore torpedoes and things like that for cutting down trees. Makes it look simple, but they're not, and dangerous to put in place.
Did you feel when your training period was over that you were pretty well up to fighting as a jungle?
Oh, yes. I think in fact, at one stage, we had to hand our blank ammunition in, and we're flown in Hercules to the Thai border, actually, because the Thai insurgents were coming in, or the tourist insurgents were coming in. But by the time we got there, the 22 SES had done what had to be done. So we stayed there, changed our ammunition from live to blank, got on our Hercules aircraft, and we're flown back to our part of Malaya. But there was a possibility that we were going to be used for tourist insurgents, but the old SES did the business. I reckon by the time we'd finished that, we would have been all right had we had to go in to do anything. We were well trained.
How long was the training? What period?
We were there from May to September.
That was quite a spell.
Oh, yes. Concentrated training. The whole battalion, like I said, did jungle warfare training and then went straight on to do exercise Basadu Padu, exercise Salon.
And what was that exercise?
It was tri-service, Army, Navy, Air Force, doing everything you would in Vietnam, resupply, patrolling, ambushing, etc., etc. Like I said, 4-2 commando had been digging in, as the Vietnamese used to do, tunnels and everything underground, and we had to go and root them out and sort it out. And it worked. Took something like 3 years to write the exercise, and of course they should have won, and they did, and our battalion did, and said, oh God, that shouldn't have happened. But and I think it's because we're well trained.
Is there what is the right word, a field training, what was the method of attacking an underground fortress like that, as an infantry person?
Well, you'd put your hunter force out along the flanks, and you'd put your stops out, and the idea was, because you were always living in the fear of the booby trap, and the Vietnamese used to leave a library book there, you would pick the book, go open it up, and that would be full of explosives. So you had to locate, if possible, the entrance tunnel or one of the entrance tunnels, clear it, get in it, and then actually clear along in front of you, which was always dangerous because, the Vietnamese would leave booby traps behind them. So you were always like living in fear of the booby traps in front of you all the time. So that was always scary. But the way we designed it, they made us look for the trenches and the booby traps and all that to get that part of the experience. But really, the Marines were fighting in the open. And even if it was a map reading error, I think we came up the wrong side of the mountain and we attacked from the back, so we won. We were supposed to have come up the front, I think, and we should have been, like, wiped out head-on type thing. Or our company commander was very good at that day, and he came up the way we wanted to, but we came in the back way and wiped the enemy out, so it was good. And then...
Most dangerous occupation going into a tunnel, presumably. I mean, the first man going in must have been a bit nervous, to say the least.
Well, you throw grenades in first anyway, and hopefully clear it or destroy any booby traps. But the main thing was booby traps.
So after this exercise, where did you go?
We came back to Malaya.
At the end of exercise Salon, we're starting to prepare to move out, and we're going to close part of Bainet Camp Down, which was the jungle warfare school. And they asked for a rear party. That was soldiers who were willing to stay back and destroy or backload jungle warfare training equipment to wherever it was going to go. And I was one of the volunteers. Meantime, while that was happening, the battalion was setting off to go back to Colchester by flight and some by ships. In Northern Ireland, we heard on the news that Northern Ireland troubles were breaking out with the marches. And somebody said, oh, to Allah you're going. And we said, well, I shouldn't think so. We've just spent the last 4 months jungle warfare training. However, off went the battalion. I stayed back for an extra fortnight, burning half the camp down in the stores because it was cheaper to burn it than it was to try and transport it back to England. And then it did come on the news saying British troops are going into Northern Ireland. And we got back to Colchester a fortnight after the rest of the battalion who'd had leave. And they said, right, rear party, you've got 12 days. About 10 of that would be leave, and then you're back here, and we're off to Liverpool Street to get on the by train to get on the ferry to Belfast. And we thought, we still didn't believe it, but sure enough, a little bit of leave, back, and there we were, taking all the inside of our Land Rovers and everything out, and our canvas canopies off, and making them ready for Northern Ireland for riot controls. And believe it or not, within 12 days we were in Northern Ireland on the streets.
You had not received leave yourself, had you?
Yes, we had. We got a shortened leave so we could catch up with everybody else who had their leave in preparation of all our vehicles and everything to move into to Belfast.
Was your mother still alive at this point in time?
Is.
Your mother's still alive, so you went home
to
your
mother? Oh, yes, yeah.
You went home
to your mother? Yeah, I came home to my mother and had leave.
Had her condition improved? I mean, she was still, you know, she was working pretty hard and...
Well, she was still going. I mean, Michael was, Paul was still at school, and she was chipping on, and she was just getting on with life. We never had any money anyway, so you know. But we were all growing up, so she wasn't looking after small children anymore. At least.
So was she in the same house?
Yes, we're still in Westview. Yeah. So shortly with my mum and the kids. And then, as I say, back to Colchester, did the last little preparation, and then set sail by ferry to Belfast. This was September. This was September 1969. Now,
you haven't. Have you met your wife to be yet?
No.
You haven't got that far.
Still young and single.
The following tapes. Major Lawton's experiences and memories of Northern Ireland and are therefore need to be protected.